Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 11, Basics of M&A Transactions Involving Hedge Fund Managers, Microsession. Robert Goldbaum, Cheryl Orr, and Jim Collins will discuss the basics of M&A transactions involving hedge funds. Now, on to the podcast.
So it's great to be here. We would say two things. First, in a sense, every asset and wealth management transaction is a bit different from each other. But that being said, the market presence of the team we have, I think, has enabled us to pick up on significant trends that are happening, types of deals. The first trend that we're seeing is significant asset aggregation. Larger asset managers looking to accumulate AUM where they have economies of scale and where they have the brand and the presence to be able to internalize and just grow their balance sheet assets as part of doing acquisitions. This is happening a lot, particularly in the structured products area, CLOs and CDOs, but also more broadly. We're continuing to see asset managers doing tuck-ins and other acquisitions of manufacturing capability when they're looking to really harness and make use of their distribution networks globally. And as a result, when they're missing a product set or specific styles or types of products, we're seeing acquisition for that purpose where they can harness it to their distribution and really move the needle for both themselves and the target. And then most significantly to the folks in this room, we're seeing an increasing number, particularly in recent years, of strategic minority investments that are being made both by asset management firms like AMG and others, but also by pools of capital that have been formed for this purpose at places like Blackstone, Neuberger Berman's Dyal Fund, Peters Hill at Goldman Sachs. And these transactions, I think, are particularly relevant to the folks sitting in the room. In addition to a check and diversification that come out of those deals, they also bring a bunch of significant strategic benefits to the managers. There are folks who, in the O's, would have said that, you know, running $5 to $10 billion of assets at an alternatives firm was already scale, and you could go it alone. I think we're seeing an increasing trend, whether it's from a regulatory uncertainty perspective, just macro trends that are happening and making the world a scarier place, that having an affiliation with somebody who's got a larger brand and platform, and particularly outside of the U.S., in addition to bringing a halo effect that helps add credibility for bringing in new investors around the world, you know, you also get access to best practices, you get access to strategic help on tuck-ins and hirings that you're going to do at your own firm. And particularly outside of the U.S., you get the credibility that comes from a big brand that's been heard of by CIOs when you look to raise money for pools of capital outside of the U.S. Globally.
Thanks, Rob. Jim, minority investments seem to have become the transaction du jour over the past year, and I know you've been working on a lot of them. Are you seeing the same trends that Rob outlined, and what are some of the going forward implications of these minority investments on asset management generally?
Sure. Thank you, Cheryl. Yeah, we are seeing the same trends that Rob is seeing, and to sort of expand on that further, in the last couple of years, we've seen more financial players who are willing to make minority investments in hedge funds. And what are the implications of that for a transaction and for the hedge fund? So in a minority deal, one of the things to keep in mind is as long as it's an acquisition of less than 25% of the firm, you're not going to have to go get client consent. So that's, you know, people usually see that as a strategic advantage versus doing a deal over 25% or a deal for the sale of the entire firm. So that helps make a transaction easier. On the other side, if you're selling only a minority investment, there are some other things you need to deal with. Most important being the relationship of the parties going forward after the transaction closes. Some of the things that would have to be negotiated would include the management and operation of the business going forward. So what rights is the minority investor going to have? You know, if there's a board of managers of the hedge fund, are they going to have one or more positions on the board? What consent rights might they have over things like issuance of additional equity, entering into a new line of business, or taking on debt, things like that? In addition, you'll have to negotiate the liquidity provisions that are going to apply for not only the minority investor, but also the existing management and other owners of the firm. You may have to negotiate, you know, rights of first refusal and drag and tag-alongs in the event that there's a future exit, or should the firm wish to raise additional capital in the future, or existing owners take additional capital off the table in the future.
Okay. One quick follow-up, Jim. In terms of when you have a minority investment and negotiating the minority rights, do you find that one party or the other has greater leverage, or does it depend on the deal?
I think it depends on the deal. You know, I think it could go either way. If you've got a hedge fund that has a strong position because they have a very strong business and they've got investors that want to get in, you may have the hedge fund management side having more leverage to, you know, knock down those consent rights to just the bare bones few things. But on the other hand, if you have, you know, especially now that you're seeing, as Rob was mentioning, some buyers like Neuberger Berman, Blackstone, who are out in the market a lot, and they may have their playbook. And they say, you know, we know how to do these deals. Our partnership with you can be an advantage to you, but here are the things that we require. So in that case, they may have more leverage.
Because we do it in every deal we do.
Right. Right. I don't know, Rob, if you maybe are seeing it differently.
No, I think that's a fair description, Jim. It segues pretty nicely into sort of what firms can do in advance of seeking a transaction, because one of the things that has sort of moved into the mainstream, I would say, in recent years, is a desire as part of making an investment, particularly a strategic minority investment, looking to institutionalize the firm. And so when you're dealing with a target that's running, you know, $5 billion, $8 billion of AUM, they really fall all over the map in terms of how much they've institutionalized their firms on their own, how much the guys have locked arms, made commitments to the franchise, put in place restrictive covenants such as non-competes, no raids, how much they've professionalized the management of the firm and built out legal and compliance to a best practices level, but how thoughtful they've been relative to spreading the ownership of equity, particularly to the next generation of talent. So one of the things that you'll often see, and it impacts pricing in these deals significantly, is how institutionalized is the firm when a buyer arrives on the scene. And firms can really capture a lot of the franchise value increase that buyers otherwise look to capture largely for themselves if they take steps to institutionalize significantly in advance of pursuing a transaction. If you show up as sort of one team speaking with one voice, and you don't have to have a whole bunch of sort of intergenerational and partner-to-partner debates and negotiations relative to the terms going forward, it really streamlines, it speeds up how quickly you get a deal done, and it tends to significantly impact pricing, in my experience as well. And so firms that haven't, a lot of times, you know, every day is just a continuation of the day before it, so people don't necessarily go back and revisit their operating agreements, revisit service agreements they have in place. Sometimes you'll find a firm that doesn't even have a lot of their operating arrangements papered. It hurts you both from a time and certainty perspective, but also in terms of how much of that franchise value enhancement are you capturing for yourself. And so we strongly encourage clients to have those conversations and think about those things, you know, well in advance of facing off with buyers.
And I think that can also help to the point of being prepared to do a transaction. As Rob was mentioning, the other part of it I see and we often deal with is the employee arrangements and senior management arrangements going forward. And if, you know, if some of that is dealt with before your minority investor comes in, that could be good because it's done and out of the way. It may also, you know, if it doesn't satisfy the minority investor in terms of what they think are the protections and incentives that may be needed for senior management going forward, even if you try and prepare for that, it's always possible you may end up doing it again as part of the process with bringing in a minority investor.
Absolutely. This sounds like a pitch. To an extent, it probably is a pitch, but it's why having the perspective and the market perspective of having been on the buy side a lot and on the sell side a lot, if you have the right advisors, both on the legal side and sometimes strategic consulting type advisors, they can tell now across a whole data set of transactions that have happened what different kinds of buyers are going to be looking for. This chance to get it that much more correct going in so that you don't wind up having to revisit it. If you get your governance and your next gen arrangements and your commitments to the franchise to a spot that's good enough from almost any buyer's perspective, it's going to really help you. You typically won't need to go back and revisit it at the time of a deal.
Okay. So I think we have like a minute or so. Is there any questions that we can answer for anyone? I guess let me just ask this, one other thing. If you could leave them with sort of one piece of advice if they were going to do a minority investment, like maybe the first thing that they should do, what would it be?
Think about whether you have a next generation of talent in place. Think about who the future leadership of the firm is likely to be. And it's not necessary to necessarily lock all of those things in going in. But it's important to have views because those views will help both in terms of being underwritten by an investor and getting it right in a transaction process that can often be quite fast moving once it's underway.
Okay. And Jim, if you were to give one piece of advice for sort of the firm that's taking the minority investment in terms of what they should think about in terms of deal protections?
I think it kind of dovetails with Rob's point, which is, you know, the most important thing I always think of for hedge funds, well, it's two things, clients and people that work there. So as the minority investor, to piggyback on Rob's point, I think you want to make sure that you have your team in place now, but also you have the vision for the future of who's going to be running the firm 10, 20 years down the road.
And I would just encourage you to keep in contact with your counsel, because I've been on deals on both sides, actually, where our clients not really kept us in the loop, and on where the client on the other side has not kept their counsel in the loop, and it slows up the process incredibly. So thank you very much for your time. If you have any questions, we'll be around during the next break and during the cocktail hour. And if we don't catch up, our contact info is in your books, and we welcome any questions you may have. Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.